During his career at Fuller and other universities, he's taught Old Testament and Semitic languages. He earned his PhD from Brandeis University in 1964. In his speech tonight, he will discuss the biblical and theological concepts upon which Christian Zionists base their beliefs and the effects of their political power of peace in the world, and especially on prospects for justice and peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Dr. Bush.
Thank you very much. The title of the address that they asked me to do was When Faith Becomes a Barrier to Peace, and in particular, how that has occurred, a barrier to peace, in that branch of the Christian church that's now being called Christian Zionism. Until just a few years ago, that branch of the Christian church was not called Christian Zionism. It was called premillennial dispensationalism, which sounds like a mouthful.
We need to get the mic in front of you more.
A little more in front of me?
Yep.
Okay, we'll put her down here. How's that? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Premillennial dispensationalism. And if premillennial dispensationalism mattered at all a few years ago, it mattered only to Christians because it belonged to that part of fundamentalist Christianity that believed in a literal interpretation of the Bible and that had some funny ideas of what will happen when the world comes to an end with the return of Jesus Christ. But people with these beliefs are no longer simply a matter of intra-Christian biblical interpretation and theological controversy. They have become a political and social force that has the power to significantly influence issues of peace and justice, not only in Israel-Palestine, but in the larger world. Tonight, I would like to try and understand how this has come about. And to do this in brief is a monumental task. If I've rewritten this address once, I've rewritten it five times. Just ask my wife, she almost left. So first, I will give a very brief description of the historical development of premillennial dispensationalism, the belief system of Christian Zionism. Secondly, I will give a brief description of the biblical and theological concepts of dispensationalism that will enable us to understand the tragic impact that it is having on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and on world peace in general. I will not set forth, as I've already said, a full description of Christian Zionism or premillennial dispensationalism. That would not take an evening lecture. It would take a small course in biblical interpretation. Thirdly, I will try and examine the impact that Christian Zionism is having on both the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and on the prospects for justice and peace in the larger world. So first, a brief history of premillennial dispensationalism. That began with this chap right here, John Nelson Darby. In the middle of the 19th century, Darby was a renegade Irish Anglican priest. In 1825, he left the Church of England, declaring it to be apostate, and helped to found the denomination known as the Plymouth Brethren. Darby was a charismatic figure, a persuasive speaker, and a zealous missionary for his dispensational beliefs. He translated the entire scriptures, and his public works amount to some 40 volumes. By the time he died, he had founded some 1,500 Plymouth Brethren churches all over the world. Darby made 7 extended trips to the United States between 1862 and just before his death in 1885. During these visits, he came to have an increasing influence over a considerable number of the leaders of the American Fundamentalist Church, and especially Cyrus I. Scofield. It was Scofield who circulated Darby's ideas widely throughout America and the English-speaking world and made them credible through the Scofield Reference Bible, first published in 1909. The Schofield Reference Bible was a King James Bible to which Schofield added headings and dates and especially notes, which set forth in great detail his dispensational systems and teachings. The Schofield Reference Bible rapidly became, and still is, the major source of Christian Zionist interpretations and theology. Schofield's disciple, Lewis Sperry Schaeffer, founded the major American center of dispensationalist theology, Dallas Theological Seminary, in 1924. Schaeffer became the most articulate and influential exponent of Schofield's system, producing a huge 8-volume theology of dispensationalism. In addition, there were Bible and prophecy conferences and radio programs sponsored especially by Chicago's Moody Bible Institute and numerous other Bible schools and colleges, and they spread dispensationalist teaching widely throughout the United States and elsewhere in the world. As a result, by the end of the 1920s, dispensationalism had become the dominant theology of U.S. fundamentalism. According to American church historian Dr. Timothy Weber, quote, every major revivalist since Dwight L. Moody, who died in 1899, everyone has been a dispensationalist. Finally, it is important to note that dispensationalists have been outstanding communicators, skillfully using radio, TV, and lately the internet to spread their interpretation of the Bible and human history. Channel surfers on TV know that dispensationalists are master communicators. Next, let me turn then with this brief history of dispensationalism to the important biblical and theological concepts upon which has brought their system into being. The ones that are critical for us understanding why they're such a danger to both Israel, Palestine, and to world peace today. The first of these is that they are committed to an ultra-literal interpretation of Scripture. This literalist interpretation takes little account of what I spend so much of my time teaching in my 35 years at Fuller Seminary, what we call literary genre, the literary shape and form of a passage, and how that's essential for interpreting what it means. For example, whether a term is used literally or figuratively is absolutely critical in interpreting the highly visionary, extravagantly metaphorical and symbolic language of the apocalyptic. I'm getting old. The apocalyptic passages of the Old Testament, such as Daniel 7 to 12, or of course, uniquely, the book of Revelation. Yet, these are the very passages by which, by literal interpretation, dispensationalists build their system. Secondly, they are committed to what we call a premillennial view of the return, the second coming of Jesus Christ. The New Testament book of Revelation in chapters 21 to 10 speaks of Jesus Christ ruling for 1,000 years. In Christian biblical interpretation, this period is called the millennium. Ever since the writings of St. Augustine in the 5th century AD, both Roman Catholicism and all the major Protestant traditions interpret the number 1,000 as a symbol or metaphor, most often identifying that as the period between the founding of the church in the second chapter of Acts in the 1st century and the ultimate return of Christ. But for the literalists of dispensational interpretation, the number 1,000 cannot be understood symbolically. And therefore, after Jesus' second coming, he will reign over the earth for a literal 1,000 years. This view is called pre-millennialism because Jesus' return comes before the 1,000-year reign. At the end of this period they adopted dispensationalists adopted this premillennial view. Jesus will return, then the 1,000-year reign will take place. But they added to it two critically new, in the history of Christian interpretation, wrinkles. Actually, I'm going to look at just one of these in order to fully understand, and I think we, with that we can fully understand how it is that this teaching so deeply affects the Israeli-Palestinian situation and peace in general. And that is the first one there, the concept of dispensations. This concept is based on the fact that in each era, this is their interpretation, they get this out of a King James translation of a particular Greek word, oikonomia, which they translated rather inaccurately, the old King James did, as dispensation. And they believe that in each of these dispensations or eras, God has dealt in a totally different way with humanity. There are, we're going to pass over the issue of the rapture. We just don't have time to get into that tonight. And we'll talk about, I think with this we can get the feel for what they're doing. The first dispensation is the dispensation of the law, or Israel. And it runs from Moses giving of the law to Israel in the 15th century BC through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, as recorded in the Gospels, to the founding of the church in the first century AD, as recorded in the second chapter of the New Testament book of Acts. The second is the dispensation of the church, or as they call it also, the dispensation of grace, which runs from the founding of the church in the first century AD until it ends with the second coming of Jesus Christ. These two dispensations are followed finally at the second return of Christ by the dispensation of kingdom, or God's rule, the 1,000-year rule, millennial rule of Jesus Christ. Absolutely basic and central to the dispensationalist system is the distinction that the concept of dispensations makes between Israel and the church. Israel is the dispensation of law, and their relationship, God established a relationship with them that is utterly and completely legal. Israel kept the law, or judgment followed. The dispensation of the church, however, is a dispensation of grace, and it is totally and utterly separate from the dispensation of Israel. Historic Christianity, as traditionally, seems some kind of relationship between the accounts of the Old Testament Israel and the law and so on, and the coming of the church. Most Jews don't find that very comfortable, but that's traditionally been Christian interpretation. The dispensationalists separate it completely. Israel and the church have absolutely nothing to do with one another. All the Old Testament covenants, promises, and prophecies about Israel do not apply to the church, and all the New Testament says about the church has nothing to do with Israel. God deals with only one group at a time, thus keeping the two peoples and programs utterly and completely separate. Scofield's disciple Lewis Sperry Schaeffer put it this way: the dispensationalist believes that throughout the ages, God is pursuing two distinct purposes. One related to the earth, with earthly people and earthly objectives involved, which is Judaism, while the other is related to heaven, with heavenly people and heavenly objectives involved, which is Christianity. This utter and complete separation of Israel and the church has a further implication that has extremely serious consequences for the Israel-Palestinian conflict in particular. Based on their literalist interpretation, dispensationalists teach that none of the Old Testament promises to and covenants with Israel were fulfilled in the Old Testament. Since time is short, let me just mention the two most important of these for Israel-Palestine. First, you will remember that in the book of Genesis, God promised the whole promised land, the land of Canaan, or Palestine to Abraham and his descendants. According to dispensationalists, since in Old Testament times Israel never possessed the whole land, this promise must be fulfilled. I could go into some details, but that makes the point. Secondly, you will also probably remember that the Old Testament prophets announced the promise that after Israel was exiled to Babylon because of her breaking the covenant and her sin, God will bring Israel back to the land under a new Davidic king, where they will rebuild the temple and reinstitute the priesthood and sacrificial systems. All Old Testament scholars, whether Jewish or Christian, believe that this promise was fulfilled in the return of the Jewish people after the exile to Palestine under Ezra and Nehemiah. But in a footnote to Jeremiah chapter 23, which promises this return, the Schofield Bible asserts, "The restoration here foretold is not to be confounded with the return of a feeble remnant of Judah under Ezra and Nehemiah at the end of the 70 years of the Babylonian exile. The prophecy is yet to be fulfilled." Now, since Israel and the church are totally separate and have nothing to do with one another, these Old Testament promises to Israel in the Old Testament, the land and a Davidic kingdom with a Davidic head and a temple and all the temple sacrifices and accoutrements, it can't be fulfilled in the church, so therefore it can only be fulfilled in connection with the second coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of his 1,000-year rule. As Lewis Sperry Schaeffer puts it in his Theology of Dispensationalism, quote, "Israel is an eternal nation, heir to an eternal land, with an eternal kingdom on which David will rule from an eternal throne." As a result of views such as these, Christian Zionists have a number of rock-hard convictions about the Middle East. I put them forth right here. One, the land of Palestine was given to the Jewish people by God as an eternal possession. Therefore, the state of Israel must include, at a minimum, the whole land of Palestine. Second, the state of Israel is the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy that the Jews will return to the land of Palestine at the end times. Thirdly, the temple must be rebuilt and the Old Testament priesthood and sacrificial system reinstituted. Fourthly, all of this must take place either before or in connection with the second coming of Jesus. At this point, let me pause and make an observation important for those of us concerned with interfaith relations and understanding. On the grounds of these convictions, Christian Zionists proclaim that they have a great love for and commitment to the Jewish people and to Israel. But it is a strange kind of love and a strange kind of commitment. In the Christian Zionist end time scenario, which I haven't had time to go into, when the rapture takes place, which they've gotten out of one tiny little verse in the New Testament, and which teaches that Jesus comes in two stages, his first return is the rapture, and what he will do is he will take from earth all true believers. Doesn't include us Presbyterians, by the way. Or you Methodists. He will remove all true believers from the earth. That does not include the state of Israel or the Jews. So they will be among those left behind and will go through all the horrors of the Great Tribulation. In the Christian Zionist scenario, the vast majority of the Jewish people will perish in the last great Holocaust, the Battle of Armageddon, except for the few that convert to Christianity. That's what loving Jesus is, loving Jews is for Christian Zionists. Let me, with this understanding of what the basic Christian Zionist view of what will happen is, let me turn to talk about how terribly badly they have impacted the whole issue of the struggle for peace and justice between Israelis and Palestinians. To give a full account of this would take all evening, and I want to look at the larger picture, but let me just give a few representative examples. The agenda and goal of the Greater Israel settler movement of the extreme right wing of Israeli Zionism is to take over from the Palestinians as much of the territories of the West Bank, which the Israeli settlers refer to by the biblical names Judea and Samaria, as is politically and economically feasible. The West Bank here is the area where almost all the biblical events took place. In the Old Testament period, Israel hardly ever controlled the coastal plain. That was the area where the great inter-empire trunk route ran. And so this area then is loaded with implications, and the messianist Orthodox party in Israel believes that this is must be theirs. So do the Christian Zionists. Based on the rock-hard convictions we looked at already, the Christian Zionists were completely opposed to the Oslo interim agreements and accords and the whole Oslo process. When Netanyahu became the Likud prime minister in 1996, he inaugurated the, quote, Israel Christian Advocacy Council and invited 17 U.S. Christian Zionist leaders to Israel for a conference. The conference concluded with a declaration that resembled the Likud platform with some biblical footnotes, including a blanket rejection of any U.S. pressure on Israel to abandon any of the West Bank and Gaza settlements. Further, Christian Zionists are currently today utterly opposed to the Quartet roadmap, the U.S., primarily U.S.-backed roadmap, whose goal is a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The, quote, the Bible is my roadmap, unquote, declares an internet petition circulated by Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and the Left Behind author Tim LaHaye. Such peace plans are not a good thing in the eyes of Christian Zionists. By blocking them, they are convinced that they are making possible and hastening the second coming of Jesus Christ. Secondly, in keeping with this conviction, several Christian Zionist organizations have been active over the years in funding the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, especially. During the 1991 Feast of Tabernacles by the International Christian Embassy Jerusalem, one of the most radical and active of the Christian Zionist organizations, during that Feast of Tabernacles in 1991, for example, representatives from 12 countries presented checks to the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir to help finance the settlements. And in 1995, a Christian Zionist named Ted Beckett founded the Christian Friends of Israel Communities and initiated an Adopt a Settlement program among churches worldwide, but especially in the United States, with, quote, larger churches adopting larger settlements and smaller churches adopting smaller settlements, and giving all a morale boost to show them they are not alone and are loved by many. In his excellent book, Christian Zionism Roadmap to Armageddon, Stephen Sizer notes that this organization, Christian Friends of Israel Communities, claims 39 Israeli settlements have been adopted by 50 churches in the USA, South Africa, Germany, and Holland. For example, the large settlement up in the northwest of Ariel has been adopted by Faith Bible Chapel, Arvada, Colorado. And just to mention one more, the other radically important settlement in northern Jerusalem, Tzagot, has been adopted by Tarzana Baptist Chapel, Tarzana, California. Thirdly, Let me tell you about one more that really boggles the mind. Christian Zionists are convinced that the temple must be rebuilt because in their interpretation of prophecies from the book of Daniel, the Antichrist must desecrate the temple during the events connected with the Great Tribulation and the 7 years between the first and second return of Jesus Christ. In his 1999 book, Planet Earth, the Final Chapter, Hal Lindsey has written, "Right now, as you read this, preparations are being made to rebuild the temple." There is absolutely no question but what he is right. A number of Jewish organizations are involved in attempts to seize the Temple Mount, destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, rebuild the Jewish temple, and reinstitute temple worship, priesthood, and sacrifices. Among the most important of these are the Temple Institute and the Temple Mount Faithful. They are actually engaged in the design and construction work and furnishings and utensils of the temple, the training of priests, etc. All of this requires funds, and in large measure, these are being provided by Christian Zionists. In her book, Prophecy and Politics, the author Grace Halsell, which was published in 1989, by the way, reported that Stanley Goldfoot of the Jerusalem Temple Foundation was raising up to $100 million a year for the Jerusalem Temple Foundation through Christian Zionist TV, radio programs, and evangelical churches. Enough about the tragic effect that this organization is having on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Let's look a bit at the problems of getting peace and justice worldwide. Christian Zionist organizations have had a marked influence on U.S. foreign policy on the Middle East for the last 25 to 30 years. In his book on Pat Robertson and the rise of the Christian Coalition, Robert Bolton argues that the Christian Coalition, with an annual budget of $25 million and over 1.7 million members, is, quote, arguably the single most influential political organization in the United States. How did Christian Zionists achieve this kind of political power and influence? Let me briefly set that forth. With the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, Christian Zionism was kicked into high gear. Prophecy was being fulfilled. However, with the capture of Jerusalem in the 1967 war, they really felt the end times were upon them. For example, the father-in-law of Billy Graham, Nelson Bell, editor of Christianity, in 1967 said that for the first time in more than 2,000 years, Jerusalem is now completely in the hands of the Jews, gives a student of the Bible a thrill and a renewed faith in the accuracy and validity of the Bible. The major impact, the major thing that kicked them into high gear, however, was a series of books by Hal Lindsey, the first published in 1970, The Late Great Planet Earth. This book has gone through more than 100 printings, with over 35 million in print in English, with a further 30 million copies in 54 foreign languages. It was proclaimed by the New York Times to be the best-selling nonfiction book in the world for the decade of the 1970s. The book sets forth in chilling detail the ever-intensifying violence, disasters, and bloody destruction that will descend upon the rest of us after the rapture takes place, as the Antichrist inflicts upon the world the terrible events of the Great Tribulation. Lindsey has followed up The Late Great Planet Earth with a series of sequels updating all the specific modern events that he connected with the biblical, so-called biblical prophecies in the light of the changes that have gone on. In this connection, let me just pause briefly and make a second observation that is important for those of us concerned with interfaith relations. With all that has happened since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the events of 9/11, Lindsay and other Christian Zionists have updated their view of the evil force in the world that they posit will ally itself with Antichrist to attack Israel and bring on the Battle of Armageddon. The evil force in 1970 and 80s was, of course, godless communism and Soviet Russia. But with the fall of the Berlin Wall and Russia sinking to a minor force in the world, they've changed their view of where this terrible force will come from, and it is Islam. Consequently, leaders of Christian Zionism are openly hostile to Islam and have been publicly quoted demonizing Muslims and their faith. Frank, the son of evangelist Billy Graham, has stated publicly that, quote, Islam is a very evil and wicked religion. Pat Robertson and the Christian coalition that he heads have stated that Islam is a religion of violence seeking to, quote, dominate and destroy, and that the Muslim faith is, quote, a monumental scam. Finally, in the most irresponsible statement of all, on the 60 Minutes program, Zion's Christian Soldiers, which aired on October the 6th, 2003, a portion of which I will show in another connection in a moment, Jerry Falwell said, I think Muhammad was a terrorist. I have read enough of the history of his life by both Muslims and non-Muslims to know that he was a violent man, a man of war. In terms of interfaith relations, ladies and gentlemen, this is utterly tragic. But let me move on to look at another reason that they are so successful. They have had at their head a series of very skillful communicators. This man, Pat Robertson of TV 700 Club, chairman of the Christian Broadcasting Network and president of the Christian Coalition. Equally important is Jerry Falwell, whose Jerry Falwell Ministries sponsored the Liberty Broadcasting Network TV channel and is syndicated Old Time Gospel Hour program, which is broadcast on 350 stations in the USA and has a budget of $60 million. Both of these men are avid Christian Zionists. Consequently, the influence of dispensationalist views of the world and the end of the world and what is constitutes peace and justice is now pervasive within right-wing evangelical and fundamentalist churches. In his book, Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon, Sizer estimates that these churches are now led by 80,000 fundamentalist pastors across the country. Their views are disseminated by 1,000 Christian radio stations, as well as around 100 Christian TV stations. But the impact of Christian Zionism does not stop there. In his 1992 book, When Time Shall Be No More, Prophecy, Belief in Modern American Culture, historian Paul Boyer found that in addition to the millions who are committed to the Christian Zionist system, there are millions of others who are not so well informed but still believe the Bible contains valuable clues about the future. Such people are susceptible to popularizers who confidently weave Bible passages in end time scenarios or who promulgate particular schemes of prophetic interpretation to explain what is going on when the world seems to be falling apart. Boyer concludes that dispensational views about Israel and the course of history have influenced popular opinion far beyond the boundaries of the dispensational movement. One only has to think, and I didn't take the time to mention this, of the incredible influence that the Left Behind novels are having across the world, and they are not all dispensationalists that are reading them and believing that they have some kind of truth about what the future stands for. 60 to 70 million of these have been sold and are in print, and if you walk around to Presbyterian churches, that's the ones I happen to know about, you'll find them on the shelves of libraries. Turning to the 1970s, the Christian Zionist went political. Jimmy Carter was elected as president in 1967 with significant evangelical Christian support. Carter was no Christian Zionist. As his later history has demonstrated, he has a deep commitment to justice and peace. But he faced the emergence of Jerry Falwell and the moral majority. And so when, in a speech in New England in March of 1977, Carter stated his conviction that the Palestinians deserved a homeland, Christian Zionists joined with the pro-Israel lobby, AIPAC, and the ADL to organize a national campaign that kicked into high gear in the fall of 1977. A full-page ad in the New York Times entitled "Evangelicals Concerned for Israel," signed by Falwell and Pat Robertson, among others, stated, "We must not let the president give land to the Palestinians." Though doubtless other factors were involved, such as Iran and the hostages, Christian Zionist opposition played a significant role in Carter's defeat. That brings us to Ronald Reagan. Carter's defeat brought Reagan into the White House, the most pro-Israel president prior to 2000. In an article entitled "Beyond Armageddon," written in 1992, Donald Wagner writes, "The election of Ronald Reagan ushered in not only the most pro-Israel administration in history, but gave several Christian Zionists prominent political posts. In addition to the president, those who subscribed to a Christian Zionist theology included Attorney General Ed Meese, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, and Secretary of the Interior James Watt. On at least six public occasions, Reagan expressed belief in a final battle of Armageddon. And in a personal conversation reported in the Washington Post in April 1984, Reagan elaborated on his own personal convictions to Tom Dine, one of Washington's chief pro-Israel lobbyists. He said, "You know, I turn back to the ancient prophets in the Old Testament and the signs foretelling Armageddon, and I find myself wondering if we're not the generation that's going to see that come about. I don't know if you've looked up any of those prophecies lately, but believe me, they certainly describe the times we're going through." In another article, Wagner writes, "A little known feature of the Reagan White House was the series of seminars organized by the administration and the Christian right with assistance from the pro-Israel lobby." This is incredible, ladies and gentlemen. "These sessions were designed to encourage AIPAC and Christian Zionist organizations to advance their respective agendas. Participation by the Christian right in gala dinner briefings at the White House reads like a who's who of the movement, including author Hal Lindsey, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, as well as Tim LaHaye, co-author later of the Left Behind series, and Moral Majority founder Ed McAteer. In 1982, Reagan invited Falwell to give a briefing to the National Security Council on the possibility of a nuclear war with Russia. And Hal Lindsey claims that Reagan invited him to speak on the subject of war with Russia to Pentagon officials. Now what, these men with the expertise they have any input to give to the National Security Council or the Pentagon other than their distorted views of what the future is going to bring boggles the mind. Let's turn now to today. This brings me to the current scene. It's without question that Christian Zionist organizations and the pro-Israel lobby are among the most significant special interest groups that shaped the Bush administration's policy toward the Middle East. Since 9/11, three groups have come together, sometimes in actual collusion in committees and in actions, but mostly because of their common commitments. The Christian Zionist organization, with its millions and millions of followers, the neoconservatives that Bush has put in power in most of the echelons of government, and the pro-Israel lobby. I think it's important to say pro-Israel and not pro-Jewish, or not to avoid any taint of any kind of antisemitism, the pro-Israel lobby of AIPAC and its alliance with Likud. Since pictures are worth a thousand words. I want to show you a few minutes of the CBS 60 Minutes program entitled Zion's Christian Soldiers, which aired on October the 6th, 2002, which date you will remember was just a few short months after the Israeli army brutally invaded the West Bank the previous April and occupied it completely in June, occupied every square foot. Bush not only said nothing more about the Israeli invasion and reoccupation of the West Bank in the late summer, whole summer and fall of 2002, after 100,000 emails and letters flooded the White House. See, that's the problem, folks. How many emails and letters could we amass in the opposite direction? Not only did he do nothing in that summer and fall, he took a hands-off position on the conflict for the rest of his whole first administration, leaving Ariel Sharon free to pursue his brutal repression of the Palestinians. It is also clear that Israel learned a lesson that summer, namely, that even when the Bush administration criticized Israel, the Israelis should not take it seriously, for they could rely on the support and power of the Christian Zionists and the pro-Israel lobby. As Falwell said, the Bible Belt is Israel's safety net in the U.S. This is what I was talking about, this convergence between the neoconservatives, the Christian right, and the pro-Israel lobby that dominates the Bush administration. The last two lines ask a very important question in our present context. Will Bush's support in the Christian right allow him to advance the roadmap? Now, in my opinion, the roadmap is seriously flawed and is no panacea, but it is a step in the right direction, and it is the only game in town. So, you may have read the article in last Tuesday's LA Times, which reported that President Bush and Ariel Sharon clashed sharply this past week over the Sharon government's plan to greatly increase the Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim, which would essentially cut East Jerusalem off from the rest of the West Bank and just complete the massive band of settlements across northern Jerusalem, which runs all the way down with Ma'ale Adumim, all the way down to 7 miles from the Jordan River. Ma'ale Adumim doesn't have has the largest settlement of about 30,000 people, but the actual buildings are quite small compared to the area that the Israeli Knesset has voted to belong to Ma'ale Adumim. That huge area, which runs all the way down to 7 miles from the Jordan River, is an area of 21 square miles. To put that in context, the area of Tel Aviv with 400,000 inhabitants is 20 square miles. Beni Kasriel, the mayor of Ma'ale Adumim, has publicly said this is the most important settlement in the West Bank because without continuity, there can be no meaningful Palestinian state, and Ma'ale Adumim cuts the West Bank in half. So this building of 3,500 new housing units in the area E1, which lies between the western edge of Ma'ale Adumim and the eastern edge of East Jerusalem, completes the cutting of the West Bank in two. In that article last Tuesday, in reply to a reporter's question about mixed signals on settlement expansion, Bush is quoted as saying, "I've been very clear. Israel has an obligation under the roadmap. That obligation is no expansion of settlements. Let us hope that, unencumbered now with re-election concerns, Bush will this time reverse his craven cave-in of the summer of 2002 and have the guts to stick to his guns. Even if he does, however, he will undoubtedly face opposition, not just from the vast numbers of the Christian right that we have been talking about, but from Congress itself, which is deeply influenced personally, in persons, by Christian Zionism. Consider three examples. Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader from Sugar Land, Texas, just outside Houston. DeLay is a passionate Christian Zionist, and his past actions indicate that he will use all his power to oppose Bush's efforts to implement the roadmap. When Bush announced the roadmap in June 2003, within weeks, DeLay was on a plane to Tel Aviv at the invitation of Ariel Sharon. He addressed the Knesset, and he said, "I am an Israeli at heart. Don't worry about the roadmap and the president. My friends and I will take care of this in the Congress. You have nothing to worry about." And they did it. They sabotaged the roadmap, and it was dead in the water through the rest of the Bush's first administration. Secondly, James Inhofe from Oklahoma is also a Christian Zionist. He publicly, in an address to the Congress in 2002, with an open Bible lying on the table where he was speaking, said the following: "I believe very strongly that we ought to support Israel, that it has a right to the land, because God said so. In Genesis, the Bible says, 'The Lord said to Abram, lift up your eyes and look. All the land which you see, to you I will give it, and to your seed forever.' That is God talking. This is not a political battle at all. It's a contest over whether the word of God is true." I was going to mention Dick Armey. He's not in the Senate anymore, but he basically espoused ethnic cleansing. And so this brings me to the conclusion, and I'll just leave that up rather than state it. I have found working with Sabeel, the Palestinian Ecumenical Theology Institute of East Jerusalem, very helpful in its attempt to articulate what is necessary for reconciliation and peace and justice between these two terribly suffering peoples, the Israelis and the Palestinians. That brings what I wanted to say to you about what beliefs of Christian Zionists are influencing their actions and what those actions are doing, both in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in the issue of world peace at large.